Professor Wren, Immigration Law Class, 26 November, podcast number 2, and room number
243.
Yeah, let me pick it up for you.
Oh, yeah,
no,
you know.
Right,
exactly.
So if I get married,
I don't know.
I hope it is.
Obviously,
right.
Okay.
Just take one of the other students' papers, that's all.
I love this man. That actually was my first spot. And I like where you wrote Boyd up.
Boy, he's considering who he was handing it into. Remember, there was an artist who used to make his own stamps, and he considered it a performance art because he would then try to mail them and see if they actually went through. And the post office wasn't happy about that.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Because apparently if it had a cancellation mark, the self-drawn stamp suddenly became worth, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars.
I actually guarantee some of them went through.
Especially this was probably in the 80s, so I don't think they were sophisticated. Hello.
Is the second time
I'm
too, or just
there's two.
Every
semester, somebody puts a name on it. I'm like, okay, wait, is this a student in my class?
Yeah, sorry, that's definitely.
Is that today's homework?
Yeah.
Did Laura say you had to put the address?
I think in the email, but I think read mine.
I didn't get an email.
There's an email.
Just turn it in. You know, she's actually not grading it.
Oh, well, there you go. She wrote in the email that...
She's a tough grader. Oh, we always joke because everybody always assumes that she's the nice professor.
You grab my test then?
No, you know what we do is I write half of the questions and she writes half, and I grade for my half, and then and I actually give the grades on each section based on the curve, because I figured it's easier to just do that than to try to fit everybody in later on.
Oh, so you actually grade on your questions rather than switching that up?
No way.
Really?
No way. Because I don't practice in all areas of immigration.
Oh, okay.
I mean, this is a 3-hour-a-week job for me, so she's... she does it all. I don't.
Gotcha.
I did her job for one semester. I was like, man, I'll never do this again. It's a lot of fun to work with students 3 hours a week, but I'm very used to working in an immigrant community, and so when you're doing this as a 40-hour-a-week job, you get very disconnected from what you're, you know, you came in for. Not that she does, but I don't have her moral fiber.
You've been very busy lately. Let me tell you a new thing. You kept it in the paper for a long time. You're doing good.
You know, Levy's whole thing was he wanted to be one day soon. And I had been pushing our groups to hit them hard last spring. And frankly, they didn't have the backbone.
And you found the perfect, I mean,
well, I'm not gonna say
an unfortunate situation, right. But you got to at least...
It illustrates
advance.
A lot of the points that we've been
Absolutely.
Making. And it's been very good because his family has wanted it. To do this. Because there were several different approaches that the family could have used. They could have said, it's the kids, it's their parents, etc. And the Brother Jose is just been very emphatic that the Ecuadorian community in Pachuca has felt under attack for 4 years because of the Navy's you know, and that the cops who, I just did a little piece on it today, the cops, you know, that morning, it's believed that 2 to 3 of the attackers were involved in 2 early morning attacks. Neither of those attacks were classified as hate crimes by Suffolk County Police, even though in one case, 2 of the attackers, Tosh and Danch, actually beat up a Latino man. When another Latino confronted them, they went back to their car, drove the car over, and started firing BB guns at them, screaming, you know, get out of here, stick, go home, type of crap. And, you know, we said to news desk, you know, if Marcella hadn't been murdered, nobody even knew that these crimes occurred because the police didn't investigate them, didn't make any effort to look for these. I mean, how many kids are out of court talking about it?
Exactly.
You know? And we're also dealing with, like, a lot of the people in that area saying, oh, these people are my kids.
You're
going out getting drunk every Friday night.
You don't have a community out there that's behind you, I'll tell you that.
It's a weird situation because, you know, look, I
grew
up...
Because you know what their justification is at the end of the day, and this is pathetic, is they're saying, well, they don't belong here anyway.
Yeah, well, we've gotten some notes saying, you know, and this is the Minutemen did their demonstration on Saturday afternoon saying, if he had been deported, he'd still be alive today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I wrote a little note saying, had his mother not borne him, he you know, he wouldn't have been killed. You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, I think they're saying, you know, what kind of protection do they get when they can't afford the police? So, you know, at the end of the day, they don't have anything to turn to.
And our groups work closely with the Nassau County Police in training, helping them with recruitment because they're only 1% Latino.
Right.
And we were starting to work with the Suffolk Police when the Republicans were in. But when Levy came in, he cut off all contacts with the immigrant groups.
We used to get the word out now, and that's, believe me.
Yeah. What's that? No. If anyone would like, we have cannolis, cookies, pastry, and coffee. So please come on up. No donuts. This is the new homework. This is the old homework. There's 2 sets of homeworks there.
Oh, really? I just saw the first one.
Okay. Yeah, one of the students, you know, it's into the show, even if they get a hold of it. Or you guys get a hold of it.
Just a child. This was a new homework.
This is for the new homework, yeah.
Regular.
Yeah, they didn't give me napkins, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Nope. Oh, my pleasure.
That's it. That's why you're here. I'm just going to make a mess. Oh, no, it's enough. I don't want a lot. I'm a baby when it comes to
Thank you.
There's no napkin. Do you want coffee?
Yeah. But go ahead.
I can pour you some.
Oh, thank you.
What? A sugar? Stirrer, yeah. How much do you want?
Yeah, a little bit more.
That coffee smells
so.
Do you want some?
No, I'm trying to be good.
You're trying not to do it?
Trying to be good.
Even when it's
right here.
Even when it's free?
I was at the gym this morning.
I'm still getting my stuff. I'm going to bring you a shirt. I'm so cleaning. Putting it off, too. Calm yourself. Can you pour me, like, a little bit of milk left than that?
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. You better not do that. I don't think I'll marry someone that's like that.
Sit there.
I don't think we're
going to go right there.
It's new.
It's I
remember
why I did that.
I just decided to go with, you know, whatever. I just wasn't sure what I was going to do. So I was going to part two. You know, and the thing that made you feel like everything, you know, that part one was the name that was in here.
Oh, yeah.
And then part two was, you know, what is exactly that you're applying.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't sure what we were doing.
I was thinking.
And when I was reading the instructions, all of a sudden, it was like,
I didn't see it. I'm not doubting it, but.
As you were trying to.
Now, these are the ones you're supposed to be turning in now.
That almost seems to be like one.
So if you're looking through there, you're going to look at someone else's side.
I don't know. I don't care.
Homework
for it.
I'm just
going to. Let's do today. This is homework one and two, which work carefully separates the
information. Yeah, I know you can do it.
I was not here on the day that Boris gave this out, but everyone else. You here last week? Boris gave the assignment last week.
Was it a handout or was it?
Well,
the only time I get
the
letter on my computer, I won't get it once I get it worked, but I always put the form on a flash drive.
As I say, these work carefully organized.
I don't know, maybe it's my
maybe
part.
It's my I did one mistake.
Maybe you just don't have a correct
I don't know, that was
idea. I just didn't get it.
I don't know.
I will not remember it.
Can I hear you?
Okay. Just very quickly, we're going to start in about a minute. If you haven't handed your homework in yet, please do so. Okay, and we have homeworks here to pick up. They were separated. They're no longer separated, so.
That's not good.
It has to come tonight. If it doesn't come tonight,
you do not get your homework back. One of them is missing. See me at the break.
Somehow that I can make it.
And you're invited to have some coffee and some, take as many cookies or cakes or whatever as you want. Cannolis? You know, and I got more cannolis than anything else. Those are always the most popular. This could be the same.
Yes.
So I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to take a break, come back, do the class review.
I don't have anything to do besides.
What about the What's the Say for America?
No, that's all. It's all you. I did all that last
week. You did?
I didn't do the 9/11 commission, although I briefly mentioned it.
You did the What's the Say for America thing?
Yep, we had a class
discussion.
That is
so cool.
Yeah, I hit worker employment.
Yeah, you did
sanctions. I did report on it. So we had a good discussion on what our workers.
It's so funny.
Not only that, but Roy was sitting in on the class.
You're not supposed to put. No, I don't. I thought they gave me napkins. I said, "Is everything there?" And they said, "Yes," which apparently included everything but napkins.
But okay. A bunch of students did end up sending in questions 5 minutes before class.
Well,
you're one of
them. I know the answer to them. As you well know.
I actually, even an hour before, class gave me time to glance at them. So I prefer that to be strong in class.
Okay.
Yes, you did. I was saying to some students who had been in my class and were coming to do the show sheet, like, this is so weird. It's the only week ever that no one has ever sent any questions. And then in the last hour, it was like, zoop, 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 zoop.
Okay. Well, we will be getting started in about 2 seconds as soon as I find. Yeah, this is much better than the last time I lectured. I think you know I reached in my envelope and there were no lectures in it. So this one I actually have my lecture. And the way we're going to organize the class today, and we realize not everybody is here, so the only thing that's going to be tested is the stuff today.
We are being recorded.
Oh. Man, oh man. We will probably be breaking early, I think. Or do you want to run it right up to the last second?
We'll see. We are being recorded.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm always nervous when we're being recorded. Should we move that closer?
I think it's fine.
Okay. Did anybody listen to the podcast the last time? Yeah, you get the first 10 minutes of just people walking around folding papers and asking questions, right? Could you hear anything?
Yeah, it was really good after the first
10 minutes. Yeah, it was really good. You see? You weren't here. I'll do this by myself all the time. Let me just give you these before I lose them. Yeah, homework. Here, you take these. Okay, thank you. What we're going to do today, the way we've structured this is we're going to spend about an hour looking at 9/11. We started doing this class soon after 9/11, and so we've always devoted a little piece to it. I know Laura's talked to you a little bit about security issues last week, so... because she didn't want to do employer sanctions. I always do employer sanctions. She didn't want to, I'm telling you, she didn't want to do employer sanctions. She short-tripped you. On the other hand, we've never asked a question on employer sanctions on the final. Are we going to ask a question this year?
We are not.
We are not. But tell students, now we're not teaching next semester, but tell students if we ever teach this course again that we will ask a question on employer sanctions. At some point, right, we put this, what, 10 times so far? Nothing on employer sanctions. Anyway, and then after we do that, we're going to describe what the final exam is going to be like. Okay? Right? We kind of know what it's going to look
like. I mean, I went through it last class. I'll go through and answer any questions people have on the structure of the exam again, although I think most of them were answered last week, but I've gotten a bunch of answers in, questions in the meantime during the week. We will then, mainly in the second part of the class, but if we have any time left over in the first half of the class, answer the specific questions that people have sent in. Also address, Pat will address a few things that he's seen in the homeworks, common mistakes in the homeworks. I'll address some common mistakes I'm seeing in the people coming in to do the Shoshi example, which now about a third of the class has done. So, and then we'll open it up to additional questions, you know, or review as you guys want, although the quality of your answer may not be as good as if you had sent it ahead of time so that we could think about it.
And if it's for me, I won't know the answer, because I only know the answer if I study my notes ahead of time. So hopefully all your questions are on it. Well, everything I said was clear, so all your questions will be on issues that Laura said.
No, when I didn't get any questions until 5
we've never
o'clock,
had that happen.
I was like, wow, we must have done such a good job this semester.
You didn't look at the homeworks. So because we have the podcast, we should keep everything like really slow at the beginning. So well, we got some good news today, which was interesting. Was an old colleague got appointed to the Obama administration to head intergovernmental affairs in the White House, Cecilia Munoz, who's a policy analyst at the National Council of La Raza, which is the principal Latino organization in D.C. You know, it's going to be fairly interesting to see what role she plays. You know, we've mentioned briefly Janet Napolitano's appointment or proposed appointment to the head of Homeland Security, which it's a little difficult to interpret exactly what that means. I think one thing it means is, you know, you can, the Homeland Security really has three different portfolios. The first is sort of the counterterrorism portfolio, although, you know, contrary to popular belief, the CIA and the FBI are not part of Homeland Security. So, you know, Mike Chertoff sort of fit that aspect of Homeland Security's role. You have the, you know, the disaster recovery area, because FEMA is part of Homeland Security, and that's really never been adequately filled since the department was created. And then you have the immigration portfolio, and it seems clear that Napolitano has been brought in specifically to deal with the immigration portfolio. So I would say that, you know, irrespective of her particular views on particular immigration-related issues, some of which Lars and I disagree with her on, or I do, you agree with all her bad stuff, right? That, you know, it definitely is a signal that the Obama administration is looking at immigration as a serious aspect for Homeland Security. And it's sort of interesting, you know, somebody asked me, well, where does Tom Ridge, who was the first and founding Secretary of Homeland Security, fit in on those three portfolios? His portfolio was basically to panic people. He invented the multicolor threat scheme, which Stephen Colbert now parodies with bears, constantly showing up as number one threat to America. You know, every time you go into Homeland Security, they still have it at Rosedale. They have a little flip chart. It's just pieces of loose leaf that are different colors, and it's like, today's threat level is, and it's orange. And I'm like, so what do we do? You know, as I said, you know, what do you do when it gets to red? You know, you set your hair on fire and run around in the street screaming. I mean, I don't know what you know, it's like this threat to the subway. So what are we supposed to do? You know, do we get a discount for riding the subway since it's going to be attacked by terrorists? You know, there's some kind of emotional harm that we're suffering. I think we should get like a 50 cent off coupon as a result.
I don't mean to belittle it, but I don't know if this may,
why don't you
may be too young to know this, but when I was a kid and I would like drive like to the national parks, there'd be a sign with Smokey the Bear saying, "The forest fire alert today is moderate," and that's exactly what it reminds me of. Like, you go into Department of Homeland Security and here's a little sign, but it looks less professionally made. That
and it doesn't have Smokey the Bear. Like, Smokey the Bear was reassuring. Tom Ridge was not.
I never found Smokey the Bear reassuring, but never mind.
He was a good bear. Anyway, I don't know if you saw it, Stephen Colbert's Christmas special.
I have not.
It's very funny because Elvis Costello was eaten by a bear, and they have to come in and cut the bear open to free Elvis. Don't let the kids watch. We're going to talk about 9/11, and we used to talk about this with quite a bit of immediacy, and now we realize that for about half of you, you were in high school when this happened, so maybe it's a little less immediate, or maybe it's more formative. How many folks were living in New York back in 2001? I mean, for anybody who's living in New York, I mean, you know, we remember just how terrible things were that day, how frightened we were. You know, I mean, a lot of people I knew were either in the building or had just down the block from the building and watched the building collapse. So, you know, certainly even if you were living in Brooklyn or on Long Island or in New Jersey, you you didn't just know something was going on. I mean, streets were closed, ambulances were flying back and forth. You know, you couldn't get through to your kids. My kids were in school in Suffolk County. Couldn't get through to the kids. Couldn't figure out. A lot of the kids weren't notified that the attacks had occurred until the end of the school day. You know, and then really for about a week, everybody was trying to figure out if somebody knew had been killed. I remember my wife and I we decided on the Sunday after 9/11 to drive out to Montauk because we had been going crazy that week. I mean, you couldn't work. I mean, people were just crying all over the place. I remember just seeing people in Garden City with their heads in their hands, you know, crying. And I remember we were driving out to Montauk, and we decided we'd invite one of our friends along the way to come with us to get some lobsters. And she said, my brother was killed. I remember one of the lawyers who worked with me at the Central American Refugee Center said it was disappearing a lot, and you know, he was looking for his cousin. They thought his cousin had been injured. Of course, she had died. And, I remember going to my cousin's funeral. He had been killed, and fortunately for his family, they actually were able to find a piece of the body, so they were able to have a funeral for him. You know, at that time, there was a big focus on closure. But my friend, whose brother was killed, I say they never found his body. They actually found a piece of it this year. And, you know, of course, that was less closure and more just reopening the old wound. But, you know, the whole idea of what happened on 9/11, now that's getting a little remote. But I think it's useful for us to always remember the importance of security issues in immigration, because you know, people came into the United States and did great harm to the United States, and I'm sure some of you have family members or friends who have family members who were killed at the World Trade Center. There were over 300 Long Islanders who were murdered that day. Fifteen out of the 19 people who participated in the attack were from Saudi Arabia. And it's kind of common in the media to hear they were Saudis because, and then there's a long description of why they were Saudis. But, you know, if you actually look at Al-Qaeda, although Al-Qaeda has a lot of Saudis in it, it is not a majority Saudi organization. Saudis are the largest group, but they're not the majority, and certainly they don't make up 75% of the membership. In fact, a lot of the leadership is from Egypt, from the old Egyptian jihad. Why were they Saudis? You know, I don't want to hear about the lack of opportunity or bored youths. Anybody know why they were Saudis? Yeah.
If I can make a guess, I know we have a very good relationship with the Saudi government, the judicial.
So because we had a good relationship?
So we allowed more of them into the country to study, and we scrutinized
them
less.
That's right. The first thing to remember is none of them came into the U.S. illegally. Okay? They all came on visas. And visas to the United States were much more easily obtained by Saudis than by other persons living in the Middle East. Most visa interviews for Saudis, for worldwide, as you know, focus on overstays, and very few Saudis overstay. So, you know, you're looking at a State Department with a mentality that's looking primarily to prevent people from coming into the U.S., overstaying their visa, and working. Okay? Not really focused on terrorism, even though, obviously, you know, we had had the attack on the coal, we had had the Copart Towers, we had had other attacks in Africa, in Kenya, that, you know, either Al-Qaeda or similar types of organizations were behind. For many countries, there were background checks, there were biometrics that were required. But for Saudis, it was basically 2 or 3 minutes per case that was devoted to looking at these cases. The 19 hijackers applied for 24 visas altogether, and 23 of them were granted. All but one of them came in on tourist visas. It's sort of a myth that they came in on student visas. They didn't. Now, several of them applied to stay longer in the United States on student visas, but none of the... I think actually one of them entered on a student visa. Yeah, there was only one on a student visa. None of the others were on student visas. They were on tourist visas. Those are the easiest to obtain. You know, and you can also think, like, why didn't they come in illegally? Because you come in illegally in 2000, 2001, you've got a 1 in 3 chance of being arrested, which means that you probably lose 4 to 5 of the hijackers. Certain point, you know, the Harlingen Immigration Office, Brownsville, Texas, is going to say, why are we getting a lot of Saudis crossing illegally into the United States? They might start to put, actually they probably wouldn't, but at least Osama bin Laden probably thought they would put 2 and 2 together and come up with what was actually going on. One of the hijackers, Al-Midar, is pretty interesting to look at. He was known to be an Al-Qaeda operative as early as January 2000 to the United States government, but he wasn't placed on any terrorist watch list accessible by the Department of State. And this has been a classic problem. The CIA or the FBI or other intelligence agencies will know or suspect, have strong suspicions that someone's involved in terrorism, and lists were not at that time accessible by the Department of State. Now the problem tends to be in the other direction, which is you have thousands of people on watch lists and millions of people with similar names, and they're all accessible, and there's no real data behind them, and so people are getting constantly stopped and you know, prevented from entering the United States. But at the time that he applied for a visa was in June 2001. This Department of State didn't know he was that he was somebody suspected of being a terrorist. When he entered the United States later, the INS didn't know that he was a suspected terrorist. So there was a lot of focus on just how horrible a job the INS had done, and you very rarely hear me defend the INS. The INS has no reason to stop someone as a terrorist if the people who know the person is a terrorist don't tell them. They're not doing overseas intelligence operations. They do have an intelligence capacity, but that's typically been used at breaking up smuggling rings, not at doing programs directed against terrorist organizations overseas. Particularly disturbing was the fact that the consulate issuing the visa in Jeddah had been notified that Al-Midar was under investigation 18 months earlier. So he wasn't on a current watch list, but the embassy had been notified by the CIA that he was somebody who was suspected of terrorism, and they kept no records of that. So the 9/11 Commission report says, in effect, the Post could not, quote, remember, end quote, relevant suspicions 1.5 years earlier about the same person who was traveling again with the same biographical information. And that's also important to remember about the 9/11 terrorists. They were not traveling to the United States on fake visas, fake identity documents. They were coming in under names that they had used all their lives, and in several of the cases, names that were known to the CIA, you know, as people who were meeting with terrorists or had terrorist travel patterns. You know, as we said, you know, you have one level of security is with the State Department, another level of security is with the INS, now the Department of Homeland Security. Department of Homeland Security, if they're notified, would stop someone from entering. The hijackers entered the U.S. 33 times, so almost twice per hijacker. So, you know, they're coming to the U.S. doing something, traveling back, coming back to the United States and then, you know, participating in this mass murder. Now, one of the reasons why it would be easy to avoid detection by a State Department employee who hasn't been notified, because some of these terrorists had actually had patterns of travel that would typically indicate that they were involved in something other than going as students. You know, they'd gone to, for instance, to Afghanistan, was that an average consular officer in Jeddah processed 200 visa applications per day, which means they had 2.5 minutes per application, 25 per hour. So you could imagine, you know, considering that there's a physical product that you have to, you know, Lars will tell you, we go to immigration, and a significant part of your interview is somebody grabbing stamps and producing documents and so forth. You know, a lot of what they're doing during those 2.5 minutes is opening a file, trying to figure out who it is, and then actually generating a document or a stamp. You know, when we look at the situation that the Immigration Service, whether it's INS or it's Homeland Security, encounters in trying to detect people who are entering the U.S. and who might be coming here to try to hurt us, you know, it's useful to remember how many entries there are into the U.S. I mentioned this once before. Anybody remember how many entries into the U.S. there are every year on average? It's 500 million, okay? You know, has anybody here ever lived at a border, on one of the borders? I mean, I lived, which border?
I lived in Plattsburgh.
Plattsburgh. How many, were you going to school there?
Yeah.
How many times did you go up to Canada during your 4 years in school?
Some people live every weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I lived in Buffalo, and it was common for us to just load in the car. Gasoline at that time was 85 cents in Canada. So we would go to Canada, buy gas, buy beer, buy Chinese food, and come back. And this, we do that twice a week. It was not unusual for us to go over 100 times a year. And, you know, although you say, well, you know, they should be looking for the terrorists, well, every time I'm entering, how do they know that I'm an American? How do they know I'm not a smuggler? How do they know I'm not a terrorist? You know, you put yourself in the position of the person who's protecting the border. You spend too long looking at people's documents. You spend too much time questioning them. You're going to have a line backing up. You know, if you live in a place like Buffalo, it's very common for American citizens to live in Canada, commute into Buffalo to do work, or to have work in Canada and to live in New York, and go across the border. People go back and forth all the time. Unless you're going to close the border, which periodically happened after 9/11 and cost billions of dollars every time the borders were closed down, you're going to have a structure in place where someone who has very little resources is going to have to make decisions about who's a terrorist and who's not. And it is remarkable that, for instance, with the 9/11 hijackers, there was an instance where you know, one of the individuals who's connected with the terror cell was stopped by you know, by an INS agent at the airport, and then just basically was told to release the person because they didn't have, they didn't do the investigations that they might have done. On the other hand, you know, the person you stop may be a wealthy business person who's got friends in Congress or friends at the State Department, friends at Homeland Security, and you're going to make calls. Well, why are they stopping me? You know, you always think of the lines at the airport, right? You know, I can't believe they're making a grandmother open her bags up and take her shoes off and so forth. Well, why not? I mean, if you're afraid of terrorism, you know, are you expecting the terrorists to look like Osama bin Laden? I mean, they're probably not going to look that way. They're going to try to disguise themselves as best they can and find people to carry out acts of terrorism that don't look like they just came off of the mountains in Afghanistan. You know, it's interesting. You know, I'm not going to go through the entire structure of what happened in 9/11, but it is interesting that three of the 9/11 hijackers were known terrorist associates. They were never put on watch lists. That was Hazmi, Nawaf al-Hazmi, Salam al-Hazmi, and Khalid al-Midhar. You know, what would happen if there had been better information sharing? What would have happened if they had been stopped? We don't know. We do know. Did you talk at all about what went on about NCRs and so on?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not going to go into those aspects. But you know, after 9/11, at the time I was chair of the New York of the statewide New York Immigration Coalition, and you know, we started getting calls about a week after that. That Muslims were disappearing. You know, it wasn't like people were being arrested and taken into custody and they made a call home. They simply disappeared. And we didn't know what was happening. I remember the first few days we said, well, this is, you know, probably paranoia in this community. They feel very threatened. There had been, I think there were five or six people who were believed to be Muslims, although one of them turned out to be Egyptian Christian, another was a Sikh, but people who appeared, I actually had a Dominican client who was roughed up by an anti-Muslim crowd, because you tend to find like bigots really aren't that good at distinguishing who's who anyway. Yeah, so we thought maybe there was a little bit of paranoia, or maybe some people had just decided they were going to lay low and they hadn't told their family members. And then I was meeting with Lucas Gutentag at the ACLU, and he said, you know, we're getting like hundreds of reports of this. This isn't a few people. And this was really about 3 weeks now, 4 weeks after. You know, you remember what it was like. I mean, people would call up, you know, where is my family member? Nobody knew where they were. They didn't know incommunicado. You could not tell what the charges were against them. You didn't know why they were being held. How many of them were found out to be terrorists among all those people they arrested?
Zero.
None of them were found to be terrorists. Okay? But what the U.S. was able to do was to send the message to the Muslim world that, you know, we're not so much afraid of terrorists as we are of Muslims. As Lars mentioned with the NCRs program, it originally was North Korea, every Muslim-majority country in the world, and Armenia. And then they took Armenia off the list when Armenia said, hey, we're in the same region, but we're Christians. So, you know, what better demonstration that the main identifying factor for being hauled in was your religious background, or your perceived religious background. And, you know, we have to understand that America's immigration policies are watched all over the world. Everybody, it's amazing. You know, I've had people come up to me who've been in the United States for a few days from Bangladesh, from Ireland, from Indonesia, and they know everything about the latest immigration updates. And it's something that gets talked about in a lot of parts of the world, because there is a desire to emigrate here. And when people from a particular part of the world see that people like them are being rounded up, they don't necessarily think, oh, well, that's probably a good thing. They think, oh, you know, they're singling people like me out. You know, and particularly the way this was going on, because it was people being held incommunicado or in the NCRs program, people coming in and cooperating with a governmental program and then finding themselves chained to chairs. And it was a program, what a waste of time this was. Whenever there are horrible things that happen, instead of having actual programs that deal with the issue, what you often find is programs that deal with the public relations problem. So we would talk to people at INS. We'd say, well, you know, what kind of training do you have? Because basically this was to find terrorists. How do you determine that? And one of the officers says, I asked him, do you know Osama bin Laden? I mean, this is really what was going on. You know, if there was a terrorist among them, and if they had taken that day of training where they say, don't tell them you're a terrorist, then they weren't going to be found out as terrorists. But if they'd skipped that day, I guess they might have, oh yes, I am a terrorist. You know. So, you know, you had a situation where the U.S. needed the cooperation of the Muslim community in this country, and instead of fortifying the relationship, the U.S. basically took a community that had always been law-abiding and extremely cooperative with law enforcement and basically turned them into pariahs who felt that the FBI was now their enemy. It's sort of similar to what I'm seeing out in Suffolk County with the local police and the immigrant community. If you treat people as pariahs, they're not going to cooperate with you. They're going to adopt a stance of non-cooperation because the fear is if you cooperate, not only could it go against you, but it could go against other people in your community. So it's something that's had a really negative impact both on our relationship with the Muslim communities here in the United States and with Muslim communities worldwide.
I think, you know, and this is actually similar to Suffolk County, too. I do think that there's a... that our laws have an impact on how people... what people feel like is permissible to act against a certain area. Like, if your government is acting against certain people, that's kind of... license, that means that your feelings of hostility towards them are somehow justified. You know, amidst all the other tragedies of the time, you know, we were doing, you know, a lot of the groups that I was involved with were doing volunteering to walk Muslim kids to school because they were getting beaten up on their way to school and stuff. And this is the sort of thing, you know, you're embarrassed about as both a New Yorker and as an American that, you know, you're sitting on a train and somebody, you know, who has got darker skin than you is suddenly being surrounded by people who are shouting at them. And again, just makes it worse that half the time that the person is a Sikh or something like that. So you're sitting there going, wait, please leave him alone, one. And two, the turban means that he's not Muslim, stupid. Not that you should be attacking him if he is Muslim, but... I mean, it really is a, you know, a horrible time in so many ways.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, fortunately, so we did a lot of work with Mustafa Chisti, who's really one of the leading experts on South Asian immigration to the United States. And, you know, he did make the point that in many countries after something like 9/11, we would have seen thousands of people from that ethnic minority murdered. And we didn't see that in the U.S., which I think...
We saw a handful. Not thousands. We saw a handful of them.
But, you know, but it was a very disturbing time and certainly made
and
more disturbing by the
other,
government's actions.
Yeah. I mean, there was a Sikh in New Jersey who had a gas station convenience store who was murdered by people shouting anti-Arab things at him.
I hate to say it, but I was going into Sikh-owned businesses, and they would hand out little cards saying, we're not Muslims. They said, you know, I understand why you're doing this, but it also has a certain negative connotation. Like, if we were Muslims, it would be okay to kill us.
A lot of my Arab friends were, like, putting American flags in their cars because they thought this would be a protection. Here, you know, to me, this was, like, such a, I mean, completely understandable. But what a, like, a shaming of the American flag that that was what was necessary to try to be protected against mobs and stuff. And that, you know, not what I think my country stands for, really.
That's also when we all started buying Hummers. So we could get ready for our own invasion of other countries if we needed to. I was corresponding with some soldiers over in Iraq, and one of them says, it's a really good vehicle in the desert. I don't know why you drive it on the Long Island Expressway.
Oh, that's just a reference to the people who live in the car. I live in the next to a town called Hamilton, which is right after 9/11. They have the American flag and they have the American flag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I believe the correct phrase, though, is raghead, isn't that what it, yeah. I mean, it's pretty pretty bizarre what we saw at that time.
I had, when I was in
high school, I had an Indian flag in my car, and I fell, like, mm-hmm. Well, I first looked at it and I was like next to it, and then I just took the boat out and the boat here.
Yeah.
I mean, and I hate to say it, they're legitimate worries. Like, you know, I can't tell you how many people I saw getting, like, harassed on the subway and stuff like that, and just, yeah. I don't know if that makes it better or worse. Depends on where you were.
Yeah.
I was in an all-girls school, so we had a high-class Muslim girls there, and, like, no one came in. None of them came in for much of the day after. And then, like, we had one at the chapel, and we had, like, a big talk about how, you know, they were explaining, you know, if anyone, a lot of people's parents, so it was, like, a kind of a high tension. And, like, English classes, I remember we were doing some poem called, like, Yellow Journal or Yellow Americans or something like that. It got, like, way out of hand, and there were problems, but we were just trying to handle it.
I'm sorry. It was on the Yellow Peril?
Is that the name of the poem?
I don't know what poem.
Could be.
There's some poem about, it's like, I don't know what I'm saying. There's some poem about, written by a Vietnamese woman about America. It was written during the Vietnam War. So we had to write our own interpretation of that, and it came out right after 9/11. So most of the poems were so pro-America, anti-everywhere else in the world, and that a couple of girls before they gave, like, had to read their poems and they're like, "Preface it, be like, please don't yell at me. I'm not. I was born here also, kind of a deal." And it was kind of like shocking that 17-year-old, 16-year-old girls were that.
I mean, it was, because I think a lot of this is also carried over with the immigration issue more generally. I mean, I do wonder if some of the...
I think so, but I don't think it's at all at the same level. I do think it has carried on.
I think that there's a new militants arose in the United States after 9/11. You know, I hadn't heard people talk about, like, mass killings of other people.
Well, we'd heard army type language and stuff like that before. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, prior to, you know, up to the 96 bombing of the world, mm-hmm. prior to that, the 96 had never been attacked.
Yeah.
So it was unthinkable for the United States to be attacked. We lived in kind of this little bubble of isolation and bliss, and we were never had those problems like the IRA and the Boston separatists.
Right.
We never had those problems. So when 9/11 happened, that just kind of burst that bubble, and suddenly we were part of the rest of the world. And I think, like you said, there's like a little bit of militancy going on. Everybody just got suddenly very angry, and it was almost like, how dare you bring the rest of the world's problems to our shore? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that militancy has ever really kind of gone away. Mm-hmm. I think it's still very much there, and they do want to blame everybody who's,
if you're not with us, we want to end with problems. That seems to be a mindset that we have. Okay. We only really talk about this. We used to talk about it much more analytically in terms of what it should teach us in terms of better security. But I think... even just a few years ago, we used to go through the 9/11 Commission report card. But I think that some of the issues have been addressed, you know, maybe over-addressed at this point. But, you know, one of the things that you should always just keep in mind is that obviously there's a lot of cost to lack security. And it's extremely common among people who are pro-immigrant to talk about immigration and sometimes see the security issues as a speed bump on the way to, you know, getting a good person a green card, and forgetting that many of these, that the immigration system itself would be destroyed if you had terrorists who keep coming into the country. When you are in practice as an immigration lawyer, you will be disturbed by some aspects of continuing shortcomings. For instance, I do a type of case routinely called Nakara, which I mentioned in a lecture that will not be on your final exam, so you don't have to know the name of it. These are people who lived in the United States for a long time. They then pay a substantial amount of money to have biometrics and background checks done. And usually about 7 or 8 weeks later, they go in for an interview, and about a third of the time, the person cannot be granted because they haven't gotten a response on the biometrics as to whether the person's a terrorist or not. And it's always interesting to me, and I've noted to some of the officers that the person is then sent home to wait for a letter to come to bring them back in. And they almost always see when they're... I have nobody who's been identified as a terrorist. They come back in to have their case granted. But as I noticed to the officers, you know, you're not granting them because they might be a terrorist, but you are sending them back to Hempstead. You know, and this is the sort of thing that it is difficult for me to understand 7 years after 9/11 why we don't have a more instantaneous system in place, and why periodically there have been problems even at the northern border in terms of accessing computer databases.
I mean, I think that it goes hand in hand with the fact that one of our responses to 9/11 is that we so greatly expanded the definition of terrorism. So now there's so many people who are caught up, who everyone knows, so, you know, are not any sort of risk, and so no one wants to try to go and detain all of them, and the result of that is they're not detaining them. I have no case, which we've been fighting for the last 3 years, about whether he's inadmissible as a terrorist, and the whole time he's living here, you know, which again, they really thought he was a terrorist. I have to assume they wouldn't want him living here. I did not go through the 9/11 commission, so if that's something that you should...
I don't think it's worthwhile, because it's really out of date at this point.
Okay.
Anyway, so with that, I think, unless you have something to add, we'll take a break, come back, do the review for the exam, and then any test questions, any questions people had, and then I always give a little talk at the end, which takes 30 seconds.
Okay.
But we're going to take a break, grab something. If you did not get the homeworks back, look for them, and you just need to talk to me. And I know there were two people I said should talk to Loris, because Loris gave out homeworks, and they claim that they don't understand what you said, so...
I got a phone message from you, but I just got it today, from yesterday, I think. And I have not returned that phone message because I have not literally had a minute free. Okay. Okay, did you get an answer? And if not, do you want the answer now? I will grant you you're allowed to get an answer.
Yeah, they've kind of now gotten into it.
Okay.
No, not just tonight.
Remember what you wanted to ask me?
These are the homeworks that are due.
We can look at that. We do that and submit it without any penalty for being late, because I didn't respond to people. I don't care if you take it back. You might not need to. It may be perfect justice.
Which homework are you missing?
The second homework. I started making it the whole part.
But, you know, I do say you have to keep it back the other. If you want to redo it and give it, turn it into Loris next week, I'll look at it. She said you turned it in. I'll leave that.
He made up the mix of combos. That's why I remembered it. Because I even said to him, go look for the mix of combos.
That's enough for us. We don't have any doubt being honest that you turned it in. But if it's lost, which homework was it?
It's homework two, the application support. So, Loris has the assignment, so you can take a look at it.
It's in my office, so you'd either have to follow me back or stop by my office and give it back to you. Unless somebody else has their homework paper still, in which case.
What's the date of the test?
It's the 16th. Of course we know that.
As long as you get it in by the 15th.
Which one of these scissors is the best?
I
like the one with the strawberry. Cookies are always good. I only got chocolate cookies that
the
have
cookies
chocolate.
Are never good.
These are good cookies. These aren't bad cookies.
Italian, like, cannolis are fabulous cookies, they're not.
Kimmy went last week, yeah. So I missed
yeah. some big tourists.
Oh, that's probably bad.
Yeah, Mumbai. They,
yeah.
I'm sure
it's
probably not.
It's up to 8.
It's up to 8. First off, then you come in, it's your responsibility to ask someone what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were handouts.
They captured some hotel or something like that, and they
said,
so I just don't know what happened in the 15 minutes I missed or something like that. For the beneficiary,
they
sent an email from me, though, 2 days ago. I emailed the whole class.
They it's like an retaliation for that.
I did not check my emails.
Okay.
Like the cashier thing? No, they named
you to fill out an I-45 adjustment application for the beneficiary on your prior petition. There's a bunch of things you're supposed to send with an I-45. You don't need to do all that. You just need to do a cover letter that lists everything else you would be sending besides the I-485. If your beneficiary was outside of the United States,
are we going by the
same?
You should have had the same beneficiary. If your first name, if your last name starts with that one, you should. If your beneficiary is outside of the United States, assume they come in on a non-immigrant visa, and you can say either a B2 or an F1, and just make up an admission date. And assume that their priority date is current. So even if you had somebody who wouldn't have been able to immigrate for 6 years, just pretend that it's immediately available.
And you had this
I-4
with your 485, the adjustment application. If you can email it to me, make sure you email cover letter. I had said to everyone they should put it in an envelope, correctly address it, but if you email it to me, as long as on your cover letter you have the correct address, nothing will be detracted with it.
Usually the Home Office didn't. I usually attach on the last page like the stuff that should be added. I don't know the format you want the cover letter, but I'm gonna assume that's
fine.
The way I did it.
That's fine. No.
I've been going to the gym. I'm not eating. If I didn't do the exercise, that would be more bigger.
You know, certain amounts of sugar are really good for you. And it's everything in moderation. It's
yeah.
not,
I
never have any
well,
sugar.
I've lost 45 pounds. So, I got it,
kind of revived.
Like you say, moderation, but don't go crazy.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you have health because she has thyroid issues.
No,
yeah. I used to
all
have that.
To normal. It's all back into normal.
Yeah.
I was went back into
the
medication.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had the radiation, so I don't have. I have to take medication. So my metabolism does not work well. I have to exercise a lot.
But you know what? I am a great believer that exercise does so many other things
for
you.
I think
mentally
everything.
I have to get back to it because I think that's probably one of the reasons why my headaches are getting so bad.
Exercise, drink a lot of water.
Yeah.
I drink a ton of water.
I don't drink any soda.
You know what? And this is all getting recorded.
There you go.
And they were sitting right next to a couple. It was an older couple that sits right next to us. Like, oh, let me eat burgers and hot dogs. No.
They
didn't want any.
That's who I am.
Like, we just want you guys to have a nice time. Enjoy yourself. For the game.
For the 40-something.
There is nothing wrong with being 40-something.
I'm right behind you.
No, there's nothing wrong with it.
Anyway.
Third career in my life.
I changed every decade, so I'm good for 10 years.
Well, people are always telling me they're not doing something because, you know, they're a certain age and they don't think they can lose 3 years of school or 4 years.
Like, and I trusted the biggest company signed in marriage.
Exactly. So in 3 years, you're going to be 45. How old are you going to be in 3 years if you don't go to law school? The expert said you'll be 45 with a law degree.
So one of the top partners at the firm that he got at the time graduated.
She was 61
at the time there. He said she
makes
$1 million a year.
$1 million a year and no life.
Just can never
retire. What? You could make $1 million a year? You know, if you make
$1 million a year, you could always quit. She was a top partner at a law firm.
Yeah. You could always quit. Take me 11 years.
Yeah, and then you got to add the expenses back in, so how much you actually have saved?
Right. Well, most of my friends who make really good salaries,
I was going to say, everybody thinks that when I make an X amount, you're going to be doing so well. You spend that much time.
I think we're going to. What kind of structure, right?
You know.
It's hard to do though when you have that income coming in.
So we'll start at 7:10.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell people live within your means.
I remember being at a party in LA and somebody was moving to New York and they said, "Oh, well, we understand everybody has to join a country club." I don't know anybody who's a member of a country club, but within your circle they do.
When I do people's taxes, most people who are most frugal manage their money as well. Teachers.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Every teacher I know is retired.
Most likely, yes. But let's have a meeting and spell it out just a little bit more. But it's something I think I'd be interested in. I think it would fit as an independent study really well. I guess I would just try to figure out just something that in a month it's all going to be done. And what happens if the decision doesn't come out during the semester? So in the abstract, okay. I think it'd be something I'd be definitely interested in doing, but we need to have a game plan for...
Good. How are we doing?
It would be for 2 credits. I actually only need a 1 credit class in addition to what I already have, but,
so if we can come up with a game plan, what if it comes out right away? Or what if it doesn't come, even if it comes out right at the end, what are you going to do in the meantime? What are we going to do if it doesn't come out at all?
Yeah, okay. Okay. Okay, cool. In terms of that meeting, when should I do that?
Anytime after next Monday, I am fairly flexible, and I will be here until the end of December.
Okay.
So basically,
cool.
Think about it. When you feel like you've got a graph, email me some ideas, and at that point we'll set up a meeting, and I'll try to think of things to kind of match.
Okay, cool.
Thank you. Guys, let's get going. I think Pat is on the phone with his son, so. First off, on the structure of the exam, and I told you last week, and I'll repeat it briefly, it's three sections, all of which will be worth about 33 points. The first section is short answer. My guess is, I have not kind of done the final decision on the questions. My guess is it'd be about 10 short answer questions. The short answer questions, some of them can be answered in a couple words. There's no short answer question that should be more than a paragraph. Then there are two short essays. Each short essay will be worth, you know, probably about 16 points. And there will be one long essay, and that long essay will be worth about 33 points. We highly recommend you don't spend more than 1 hour on any section as you go along to begin with. And really, the short answer, you should be finishing in significantly less than an hour. The biggest problem we see on the final exam is people taking too much time on one area and then not being able to finish the next area. This is one of the big dangers of an open book exam. You know, you can always spend 20 minutes looking something up in your book and making it perfect. Maybe it gets you two extra points on that short essay, but you've just lost 20 minutes on the long essay, and that's not a good trade. I would really recommend that you have a very detailed outline, and your goal should be do not open your text or any of your other books during your first run-through of all the questions. You should be able to answer all the questions using your outline. And then, once you get through the exam, hopefully in, you know, with plenty of time, because you've not even bothered to be looking at, you know, around in your text for things, at that point, you know, you can go back and look up in your text and add the little extras into the exam. Yes? The Shoshi example, if you knocked off the startup staff and the architects, and if you may, so that you just had the engineer, vice president, and family, and maybe stuck in one other little twist, like say the daughter had a criminal issue, that would be a long essay. Yes?
The first part, the short answer questions, is that theoretical questions or
Not theoretical.
There's no theoretical and no historical questions on the exam. In every situation, right?
Right.
No, what can it be? I'm wondering.
Should I take off that explain the history of immigration law question?
Those Chinese, how were they treated? you're going to get, and in a lot of these cases are actually ones that Loris and I have seen over the years, you know, a real client type question, and your client may be an immigrant, your client might be a business, client might be a refugee coming in, but you know, none of this is, you know, compare and contrast. This is, you're making a recommendation, you're analyzing a case, spotting problems that the person might have and suggesting solutions.
And again, repeating what we said last week, the cases will essentially be current. So therefore, an old immigration law that there's almost no likelihood would still be relevant today won't come up. You know, we did talk about the LIFE Act, you know, which if it was filed before the end of April 2001, you could pay $1,000 to adjust within the United States. You might have a client who still, you know, who was, say, on a sibling, a fourth preference category family immigrant, who that was still relevant for. So it's not as if, oh, a law passed in 1997, we don't, you know, or in 2001, we don't need to worry about that. But, you know, a 1982 amnesty, you don't need to worry about that.
These would be cases that you could reasonably see today. None of the cases will be about who is a U.S. citizen. You know, we're not going to try to have you parse through and see, you know, well, he's born in America, Samoa in 1947.
Well, you have your chart for that anyhow, so it wouldn't be very hard.
Stop it. Don't make them look at that stuff.
Oh.
We're not asking you to make any policy recommendations. The class we did on Obama and McCain, that's not going to be tested. We're not going to test you on what you heard in the guest speaking piece that we did. It's all going to be...
You already got credit for that in the discussions.
Yes.
You know, those were meant for, you know, expressing your ideas, thinking about them, and we marked down who was commenting and also if someone was making a particularly good comment, one that really we felt moved the conversation along. So it's not like those don't end up factoring into your grade, but they will not be on the exam. TPS in the car, not on the exam.
Not on the exam.
The other thing I just want to, I'll get to you in 1 second, tell people not to do. Be completely self-interested in your exam. If you do start running out of time and you realize this is because you stupidly spent too much time, you know, on the short answers, don't feel the need to explain that to us. Like, I can't tell you, of the, like, 3 people or 4 people who have problems with time, I always get someone who, instead of spending the last 2 minutes writing as quickly as they can, getting down the outline of what they wanted to say on this, which could have gotten them an additional 10 points on the exam, "Professor Wren, I'm so sorry. I'm not going to be able to finish this because, just like you said, I spent too much time." Please don't do that.
Because not only would she give you points, she'll mock you.
To all future classes.
If you write it to me, I'll be sympathetic.
Yes.
245i
is the life act, yeah, and that could be on it.
But it's grandfathered for some people.
Yeah, you're going to have... Right, you're going to have to look up, but there are certainly people who are in the fourth preference who are... almost everybody who's in the fourth preference, if they were in the United States, would potentially fit within 245i.
Even if they apply something else, they will still get filed.
Yes, it's transferable.
Mm-hmm. That's right, very good. I'm going to give you, this one is important to know. The answer is never enter the diversity visa lottery. Okay, do not waste any time. If you mention diversity visa lottery, I'll take points off it. Please do not mention it. That's an advantage for those who actually listen to this instead of, we're closing off the podcast so that nobody can hear it.
There's always some, like, question that we say, give us 3 possible solutions to that. You can tell the person has run out of visas after the first 2, so they write diversity visa.
In that tone of voice.
Yeah, that's exactly the tone that they write in.
You know, you should be a little creative. Sometimes the answer might be the petitioner should become a citizen. If they, you want to take...
Remember that immigration statuses are not static. You can change. You can go from non-immigrant to immigrant. You can go from legal... You potentially could go from non-immigrant to immigrant, from legal permanent resident to citizen. And keep that in mind. So, the best solution may be you should get off his non-immigrant visa and, petition for legal permanent residence. Or, who knows. Make a few specific points?
I'm going to make a specific point.
Okay, go right ahead.
If you haven't done so yet, make sure you tab your statute book. Most students find that it is not all that useful to look often in the case book because, frankly, most of our questions can be answered without necessarily citing the cases, although you should be familiar with the cases. But it's extremely useful for you to cite to the statute. And I always find it's particularly helpful if you both cite to the statute and use the common name for the particular relief. But if you just cite to the statute, we'll give you credit for having known what you were talking about.
I think it's worthwhile for some things to actually put the statute cite into your outline. One, so you know it. So one, maybe you don't even have to open up your statute book. Maybe you can just go along and fill it in. But for the ones that you can be pretty sure will come up, like, you know, inadmissibility grounds, deportability grounds, know right where they are so that you don't have to, you know, waste 5 minutes looking. On the structure of the exam, before we kind of get to individual problems and questions that have come up, does anyone have questions on the structure of the exam? Oh, actually, one question I got, which we will provide you with a visa bulletin. There is no space limitation, so, you know, you won't be cut off at a certain amount. The only limitation is time.
What would you say 10% of the students seem to have time allocation problems?
Yeah, about 10%. And that doesn't mean they don't finish, it's just they end up not spending enough time on one section and too much time on a different section. Okay, moving off structure then. I want to start off by running through some issues that have come up with several people who have come in on the Shoshi exercise, then maybe Pat can address some issues that are coming up on homework, and then I'll go and answer the individual questions that have come in. Probably the biggest, the kind of biggest issue that has come up repeatedly in the Shoshi example, in the employment immigrant visas, that's, and if you look on, you know, that's of course all the preference categories are in 203. Derivatives come in for both family-based and employment-based preference categories for immigrant visas. And if you look at 203D, that's a section of the statute that covers that. So if you're doing an example like a Shoshi example where you have family members that you have to consider also, you know, for immigrant and non-immigrant purposes, and you've said that the principal can come in, you know, the first preference category or the third preference category, make sure you put in there, and can bring his or her derivatives in as well. The next issue, which is a certainly a less major issue. In employment contexts, or if there's an employment essay question, don't ignore the B1. It is very limited. You know, and look at the bricklayer's case if you're not remembering the B1 visa very well. It's very limited, but it's also super easy to get, and it's inexpensive. And if your person can fit under the B1 and doesn't have a desire to be here longer or to immigrate, the B1 may be the best option for him or her.
Just make sure you know what the limitations are and who the employer is.
Yep. Yes. Yeah, it's generally up to 6 months, and usually, in fact, it is 6 months. But you can also apply to extend to for an extension.
Now, one of the things that what Laura said also is important is you cannot recommend that your client do anything illegal. Don't recommend that your client lie about their intentions.
And also, thank you for bringing that up, because
somebody who does that.
You know, there'll be a question on the client entered and then left and entered and then left. You know, at that point, he decided to apply for X visa, and there's all, you know, is he going to face a bar? There's always somebody who writes, well, not if immigration doesn't know about those prior entries. That's not the answer. You know, assume that, you know, the person is telling the truth.
Is there any procedural question, difficult procedure? I mean,
there is no question on what form do you need to fill out. For procedural things that would affect whether you would decide to file for something, you should know those. So the decision of whether you might want to go for an EB1, an EB2, or an EB3 might be because of labor certification. So that you should mention. Do you have to mention, you know, the number of the form that you would fill out? No.
Yeah, but, you know, you think of central procedural issue is always adjustment versus consular processing, and you know, there's huge substantive differences between those, you know, depending on which procedure you're employing. So, you know, you should be aware of that. You know, somebody, I've had students recommend that people who are clearly eligible for adjustment go back to their country for consular processing. You're going to lose points.
And also, I mean, it's difficult to answer because we're tying up, you know, tying to what Pat said. Think of all the things we discussed, like bars that kick in when you leave. So the procedure there actually is important because if they adjust status within the United States, they're not going to face lots of bars. So you have to know that. So it'll matter whether someone can adjust within the United States or whether they're going to have to leave. So that sort of procedure, yes. Kind of just, you know, you have to pay this amount of money. You know, this is what the fee is. You don't have to know.
Is there going to be an employment-based question?
There usually is an employment-based question.
There's always an employment. They usually, we've never had a test without an employment-based question.
We've never had, it's true.
The thing I love the most is NACARA and TPS. We never have a question on that. But there's always a question on employment base. So make sure you study your employment base. Make sure you're aware of your categories. You know, let's not have a plumber put into the EB1 category. can he self-petition, professor? No, he can't. It's important to understand those categories and why you're sending someone into the category. You know, I've had students say, well, you know, this person could be an EB1, EB2, EB3, EB4, and you're like, well, they really can't. It's okay to examine two or three different categories if the person realistically might, by some stretch, fit into EB1, for example. But, you know, if the person is not a professional, if they don't have extraordinary ability, you know, or if they're not in intra-company transfer, you really need to ask yourself why you're wasting your time on that and also why you're embarrassing yourself.
Address issues that are reasonably brought up in the question. You know, if there's no mention of writing or journalism or anything in a problem, don't suddenly suggest, you know, analyze whether the person is eligible for a journalist visa. You know, if there's no facts that might give rise to that. However, if there are facts that potentially could give rise to something, I would encourage you to write out your thoughts on it. In the Shoshi example, for those of you who did it, for the vice president, the L1A non-immigrant visa was really clearly the best visa option for him. And I would expect that most people would have thought about the H-1B and then said, well, as a vice president, especially occupation, oh, he doesn't have a college degree and he doesn't have enough years of experience. On the Shoshi question, you would not have lost credit for not including the H-1B analysis, because I do think it was clear that the L-1 was the best option. But I would really encourage you to include the H-1B anyhow, because there may be some time on the test where you do that and you're wrong. Pat and I both love to give partial credit. If you only show the final thing, like you think about, is an H-1B appropriate? No. Is this appropriate? No. You know what is appropriate? It's this. All right, the answer is this. And then you're wrong on that. We have no way of giving you partial credit unless you wrote down, you know, you could consider the H-1B, but I, you know, because he hits A, B, and C, but I think there are issues on D and E. And then if you're wrong on what you think is best, if you're right, you haven't been harmed in any way. If you're wrong, I have a way of giving you partial credit. So I encourage you to, you know, the ones that you're thinking through in your mind, write, at least jot out quickly so that I know that you've thought through them and why you decided against them. And I say that, but also keep track of time. You know, if you're hitting a time crunch, don't spend your time explaining options you don't think, you know, are the actual example. But if you have enough time, do, because you may end up needing them for extra credit. on your essays, please try to be extremely well organized. I would even encourage you to use subtitles. You know, so, and again, I'm going back to the Shoshi example just because this is the one that a lot of people have done. All right, so you're supposed to look at engineer, vice president's wife, kids. I would have subtitles for each one. You know, engineer. And then under the engineer, I'd probably have H1B, colon. This, you know, and then your analysis of the H1B. L1. And then your analysis of the L1. B1. And then your analysis. So I know exactly what you're thinking. We're not looking for moving, you know, English essays. We're looking for a clear expression of ideas.
It's all about clarity. You know, we don't, I don't know, we've never asked you to write a brief to the Supreme Court or anything like that. I mean, it's basically, you know, Joe comes in, he wants to hire five guys, advise him. You know, so you writing something flowery is kind of meaningless to us.
If you're talking about both non-immigrant and immigrant visas, pay attention to the interplay within them. Think about dual intent. Think about, does the non-immigrant visa help you out with the immigrant visa? Yes?
Refugees and asylum cases, and asylum topic. What kind of a question do you need? Can you explain a bit?
There's... If you look in your book, let me see if I can figure out where it is. There's in your book, and I don't know what page, but in that section, they give you like a sample fact pattern and ask you a bunch of questions. That might be the type of essay question there might be on it. I guess it's possible we could also do short answers on essay questions, although we never have in the past. Yeah, an asylum question, sorry. Yeah?
How did you be tested for waivers?
Yes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're a very important part of immigration.
The thing is, they're going to come up in so many things. So, you know, what I would do is look at your class schedule. We've not, your class schedule, whatever.
Syllabus,
that's the word I'm looking for. Knock out the things that we've knocked out, and the titles of the classes will tell you the areas you need to be comfortable with. We spent a lot of time on family-based immigration. You need to know family-based immigration. We spent time on employment-based immigration. You need to know employment-based immigration. We spent time on non-immigrant visas. You need to know non-immigrant visas. We spent time on inadmissibility and on deportability. You need to know them, definitely. We spent time on waivers. You need to know that. We spent time on refugee, asylum withholding, Convention Against Torture. You need to know that. We spent time on naturalization. I think that's pretty much the course.
That's the course. So that, those are the things we test on everything.
Yeah,
I mean, just to amplify something, let's also remember you're not only looking at whether the person fits within a waiver, they may fit within an exception. And I have taken points off because people have characterized exceptions as waivers, saying, oh, well, he can apply, because he's the immediate relative of the U.S. citizen, he can apply for a waiver to the lapse in lawful presence bar. And, well, no, that's not a waiver. That's an exception. So don't characterize something as a waiver if it's in fact an exception.
Yeah, and that's, be careful of all your language. Waiver and exception are a bit different. Inadmissibility and removability are different. You're going to get points off if you have an inadmissibility question and you're discussing removability. Deportability, 237. Like if you discuss 237 instead of the inadmissibility grounds, you'll probably get partial credit, but you're certainly going to lose points on that. In your outline, you should see, I hope, you will see some coherence in the course. Like, you should be able to see kind of there's family-based immigration, there's employment-based immigration, and then there's non-immigrant visas. And, you know, then you hit admissibility. There are grounds for inadmissibility, which may then block you from getting in. Once you get in, there's deportability grounds that may kick you out. For both deportability and inadmissibility, there's waivers. The asylum, and then following that, there's naturalization. You know, that's all a smooth progression. Kind of apart from that, although linking in, is asylum, withholding, and CAT, which then can, you know, feed you in one way or the other. When you're looking at deportability, the release from removal. You know, if I were you, I would know all the release from removal. So rather than trying to independent, I would have them in my outline. So rather than independently trying to think up anything that might be relevant, you're simply going to your outline saying, all right, here's all the potential release from removal. Which ones apply? It's if every single thing on your outline seems separate and unrelated to you, you need to understand the course better.
You're going to get a client. We're not going to tell you what the client's real problem is. And you're going to have to see first, are they eligible for something prima facie? Are there bars? If there are bars, are there waivers or exceptions? You know, and do they qualify for them? It's always a flowing case. It's never, you know, as Laura says, it's not something static. And you can also advise your clients in ways. And again, you're trying to advise them in the best possible way. You know, if there's a real simple way for somebody to get into the United States, you don't advise them to bring in, you know, someone else so that that person later on can, you know, you're like, well, you know, people do have a natural lifespan that ends at 80, and so that should be accomplished before they die. You know, so you really are trying to find the best possible way of getting the person in. And you can make remarks about other aspects as well, but... remember, you're always trying to meet somebody's needs. You know, you're trying to meet a business's needs, or a husband who's trying to bring in his wife.
You want to hit your issues from the homeworks?
Yeah, I've got a couple of really quick things to talk about. You know, the homeworks are generally good. Most people got full credit. Some people got less than full credit. You know, and I would just say that one way you can look at it is you get 2 points off out of... six, yeah, you know, that's like a 66, but you should really think of it as you're starting with a 98 on the final. But in terms of the thing that people got wrong a lot was valuation of assets on the affidavit of support, which does occasionally come up on the final. You know, a lot of people did a straight one-to-one. You know, their income was $3,000 under what was required for the 125%. I hope this you guys understand what I'm talking about. It was $3,000 under the 125%. They had $4,000 in assets, and they wrote, you know, well, I've got enough. Well, no, the assets are not valued. It was straight one-to-one. You know, and you need to look through your notes and see, well, how are they valued? You know, if you remember, they're typically valued at one-fifth. Of their face value. So take a look in your book. Make sure you understand that. I'd say about one in three tests has something to do with the affidavit of support. It doesn't come up on every final, but you should definitely know that. That was really the only major or repeated issue that I saw, right? Because I'd say about half the people who got points taken off on the affidavit of support, that was their problem.
Sasha? I have a question on that David. If the beneficiary has assets, how does that go into this? I know we were talking about, like, if the beneficiary employed, they have to be living with the petitioner.
Yeah.
And what about
if they have assets, they can use the assets.
But it's still...
it's still valued out. And they have to be assets that can be converted.
Okay.
You know, so... something where, you know, oh, I have a title of nobility that will be worth quite a bit someday. You know, I don't think that's going to help you very much. Okay. You know, generally, the other thing is, and people do make this mistake, when we talked about the affidavit of support, they start inventing assets, and we're like, well, you know, if we wanted to make it easy, we would have invented the assets on our own. There is another issue on the affidavit of support that I should bring up. Somebody made the, only one person made this mistake, but I think other people may have a lack of understanding about this. Just remember, the joint sponsor's income is not added to your income. The joint sponsor has to be able to meet, as opposed to a co-sponsor. Co-sponsors live in your household. The joint sponsor has to be able to independently meet the 125% requirement. The other thing that I find students do get wrong on the final exam is they believe that if they have a joint sponsor, they don't have to, the petitioner himself or herself doesn't have to fill out an affidavit of support. No, petitioner always has to fill out an affidavit of support, even if they don't meet the 125% requirement. Why do they have to do that? Anybody remember? Yeah. So they're still liable. Right. Okay, because they have joint and several liability.
Sir?
Usually put it in the petitioners.
Is it treated as indefinite?
No.
Okay. Questions that have been sent in. Plenary powers belongs only to Congress, or can the other federal branches exercise plenary power when enforcing and interpreting immigration law? Congress. It's about passing laws.
But I'm glad somebody remembered the word plenary powers.
Chevron doctrine. Can you explain it again? Yeah, Chevron has a two-step test. There's a bunch of things that are... If you're looking at Chevron on your phone, that would be important. But for immigration purposes, it's their two-step test. Is a statute, Chevron you use when a reviewing court is looking at an agency's interpretation of a law. So what we're looking at here would be, a reviewing court, a federal court, looking at the Board of Immigration Appeals or the Department of Homeland Security's interpretation of a law. The first step is the statute ambiguous? Or is it clear on its face? If it's clear on its face, that has to be what it means. If the statute is ambiguous, however, you go to the second step, and that's essentially deference to the agency's decision. If the agency's decision is reasonable, it will be upheld. And, of course, the result of that is that as long as whatever immigration, the Board of Immigration Appeals, as long as their interpretation is reasonable, even if, it's not what any reviewing court would have decided on its own, that decision will be upheld.
Would a challenge of, many of federal regulations fall into that category? Are regulations, in other words, given a Chevron deference?
Yes, essentially. The concept behind it is that Congress has delegated authority to this agency to make decisions and to make the regulations and law in this case. So therefore, the federal courts are only going to intervene to change that. The federal courts are considered less appropriate to address these decisions if what the agency is doing is unreasonable.
Yeah, the idea is the agency has great expertise in the area, plus they represent the political branches of government, and they're in a better position than a judge who might see 50 different types of matters in front of him or her in the course of a year to decide these things.
There's a question on the Child Protection Act. Could we have more examples of aging out children? For the things that are questioned, who are kind of requesting more examples, we'll do that, but I'm going to push all those till after we answer direct questions. So we'll get back to that. Factoring who is likely to have immigrant intent for age is the belief that the older someone is, the more likely they will return to their country or will remain in the U.S. I think it's very dependent on the situation. You know, if you're the parent of a U.S. citizen could petition for their parent to come in. So if they come in on a tourist visa, they can then just stay and adjust status. The result of that is that immigration may look at their an application for a tourist visa a little skeptically, because they may think, oh, you're just trying to avoid waiting for your petition to be processed. So, I mean, it's really a case-by-case, necessarily. I mean, it depends.
Case,
and country by country, you know, and personal situation by personal situation.
On that point, that would primarily, the analysis that would primarily be with regards to whether or not the consulate wants to issue the visa, right? Like a B2 visa, for instance, they would say, you know, we don't believe that you actually have an intent to return, so they have the concern would be that they would deny. In the event that they don't deny it, they grant it, is that person later going to have issues adjusting?
There is a potential issue on fraud. If you came in claiming that you have non-immigrant intent to both the embassy and to DHS at the border, and then immediately an immigrant petition is filed for you, you'll probably have to submit a fraud waiver. If you file it 5 months later, you may get asked about it, and maybe your response is, actually, I intended to go back. But somebody suddenly told us 4 months down the line that we could actually do this, and that's when we changed our mind. Or I got sick, and at that point it became unreasonable to think of going back. But you may have to deal with a fraud issue. But people remember, a parent of a U.S. citizen is immediate family, so therefore they can adjust within the United States, even if they are out of status, if
they're not out of status.
No, they can do it even if they are out of status, if immediate family of a U.S. citizen. Yeah, if they're admitted and inspected, if they're admitted. So if a parent of a U.S. citizen snuck over the border, they're not going to be able to adjust within the United States, even if, you know, their citizen child petitioned for them. But if they came in, you know, on any sort of visa, or if they were admitted, they're going to be able to adjust within the United States, even if they go out of status. And the same is true for the spouse and for unmarried children under 21, because they are all immediate family of a U.S. citizen.
Although you do have to still remember the 245i possibility.
Yeah. And the 245i, the Life Act possibility also, is if the application was in before April 2001, but I don't think we are going to see any of these cases now, unless they had a family brother or sister who then, and then down the line they switched. Do you want to take question 6?
I don't know.
I will answer it if you don't.
Okay. They're not exempt from labor.
Can you read it? They don't know it.
Yeah. Oh. Why don't you know the questions that I've been asked by you? Schedule A, if an applicant falls into one of two categories in Schedule A, then are they exempt from labor certification? They're not technically exempt from labor certification, but they've actually been essentially pre-certified.
They don't have to, like, attest to recruitment.
Right. So it's essentially a fiction in the law that they are still liable to labor certification, but they don't actually have to do any of the things for labor certification.
Of course, the reason of that is that the professions on Schedule A are ones that we decided we need more of, so they're not going to be kept out anyhow.
But let's also remember, that doesn't mean that the employer can then pay below the prevailing wages, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, just because they don't have to go through the labor certification process doesn't mean that they're not still bound by the requirements they would. I mean, if you think about it, in the EB1, for instance, where you have somebody who's in the in the first category, they're persons of exceptional ability. They can come into the U.S. and work for a dollar a year, right? They don't have to show that they're not depressing the wages for other Nobel laureates. But if you're coming in as a registered nurse, you know, the employer's going to have to show they're paying the same wages as the they're paying to other registered nurses who are native born.
If a person enters the U.S. on a non-immigrant visa that does not permit dual intent, will that person have trouble adjusting the U.S. for LPR status? I'm going to hand this over so you can do two unless you want me to do it. Just the same thing we said before. There may be a question on fraud. You know, if they come in on a B1 or an F1 or any other non-immigrant visa that does not have dual intent, they will have stated that they intend to return to their home country. So if they're then turning around and filing an application to remain in the United States as a legal permanent resident, the immediate question will come up is, well, did you lie? The other thing, and this depends on whether what non-immigrant visa that you had, you know, if you're here on a student visa and you get married and then your spouse petitions for you, you'll probably, that petition will go through before, you know, while you're still here on your student visa. You know, if you are come in on a B1 and you marry a legal permanent resident who petitions for you, that petition is not going through during the time that you're on your B1, and you will not be able to extend your B1 visa because at that point you've filed an application for legal permanent residence. Do people understand that? Okay. I hear muttering, but I don't know. Yeah. It doesn't prevent you from filing, although fraud issues may come up. But if you need to, you will not be able to then extend the non-immigrant visa to try to stay in the U.S. until your immigrant application comes through, because at that point, even if you didn't commit fraud when you came in, it's obvious to immigration or to the Department of State that you intend to immigrate, so you no longer have a non-immigrant intent. So you're, you know, your non-immigrant visa will not be extended unless that non-immigrant visa allows for dual intent.
The next question is, do unauthorized aliens violate IRCA if they're self-employed independent contractors or business owners? I'm going to actually expand that beyond IRCA a little bit, and also beyond simply the alien. First, for the employer, or the business that hires someone who's an independent contractor or self-employed. I don't know how much you went into this, but you're going to look at whether the person is, in fact, self-employed or an independent contractor. Many, many employers or businesses hire people and claim that they are, in fact, independent contractors or self-employed persons who are doing work for the business. And you need to examine whether they fit the definition of independent contractor. Independent contractors typically control their own work time. They have their own tools. They're only responsible to the person contracting with them for the product. You know, you can think of, you go to do a print job at a printer, and the printer, you give the printer the piece of paper and you expect to get 500 of them back, but, you know, the printer may not do it right away. The printer may have his or her assistant do it. You know, in other words, a true self-employed or independent contractor controls the way the work is done. You can't simply designate someone as an independent contractor, and this happens quite a bit in suburbia, where you have a woman comes to clean your house, and she comes and you give her the Mr. Clean and you give her the mop and the broom. She's not an independent contractor. She's an employee. And therefore, the employer would be subject to the Immigration Reform and Control Act, to employer sanctions, and has to verify. Now, the question is, do you violate immigration law? Not just strictly speaking IRCA, but if you're an alien and you're unauthorized to work, are you violating the employment provisions yourself? If you're self-employed, yes. If you're an independent contractor, yes. Okay. Could you be a business owner? You could be, as long as you don't actually work at the business. There's nothing to prevent persons in other countries from owning businesses in the United States. So, you know, you could imagine you could have a company that's based in Switzerland that opens up an office in the United States, and the owner of that business in Switzerland comes over for a visit and overstays the visa. The mere fact that he's the owner of a business, as long as he's not doing work there, doesn't mean that he's violating the employment control aspects of the Immigration Act. If the owner of the business then goes in and supervises people and so forth, then he would be violating, because then he would be employed. Okay? That was a good question.
Is it improper to use the more precise terms of exclusion and deportation? Yes, indeed.
Okay, and are you okay with this? I never take off for people putting removal or deportation in.
I never take off for that.
Okay, either. And if you write deportation or removal, that's fine. So, although we have always said you have to use the proper term of art, it is extremely common for immigration lawyers to still refer to removal as deportation.
We will not take any points off. Technically, it is completely proper to say grounds of deportability and grounds of inadmissibility. The actual process technically should be called removal. But we won't take off any points. Is it fair to say that unadmitted aliens are only entitled to the process that Congress gives, and that admitted aliens are entitled to full due process protection? If they do have due process protection, can they challenge the INA as violating due process? Want to take that, or should I?
You can
take the first part I would definitely agree with. Unadmitted aliens have essentially only the due process that Congress gives. Admitted aliens do have the right to due process. Nevertheless, what that due process is a kind of mix. They are entitled to constitutional protections. However, for process, you know, for example, on, you know, somebody who is getting, you know, removed for a violation of a, you know, a ground of deportability, they get the due process that Congress says. So to a certain extent, for both of them, due process is what Congress says is due process, although with people who have been admitted to the United States, the courts have, on some extreme examples, been willing to step in and say, you know, there are boundaries. So could the INA be challenged as a full due process protection? You will see that in rare cases like the Zavidas decision. But is there going to be a successful challenge to, you know, the procedure set up for removal proceedings for grounds of deportability in the INA violates my due process? You're never going to win on that.
I think only one ground where the Supreme Court has that if you left detention, then you can invoke that in the decision of the Supreme Court.
Well,
that's just the issue. Almost there, I saw that there's no judicial view of detention.
I mean, it depends on how you look at things. Like when you looked in the when you look to the right to counsel cases, even though you don't have a right to counsel, you will find there, you know, the court saying there's been a due process violation here because it wasn't a full and meaningful hearing. You're not going to see that in an exclusion proceeding.
And particularly on the security issues, there. Absolutely no, 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 even though it's not
I mean, they have some grounds to knock on. It's just that a lot of those doors haven't been opened, but certainly like the secret evidence and the various courts and stuff, those have certainly been challenged in courts, and there have been some.
Even in the different cases, even in camera, a procedure was not allowed.
I mean,
proceedings has been insisted that if it's in camera still, okay, if you are used some evidence and the court is going to judge that, and they never produce any evidence, and the people were behind and they were coming back here. Although there were some of them were not one.
I mean, some of those, some of those challenges have been successful and some have not been successful. So, you know, I agree with you in that what is considered to be due process is a very much a
limited,
particularly in comparison to what it would be due process for other people. There is some due process, though, and there are occasionally successful challenges on that. Nevertheless, unless the rules in the INA have been violated, the chances of you winning on a due process violation are, you know, unless you, there's something that you can say deprived you of a meaningful hearing or something like that. Although, if you're unadmitted, it's going to be hard to even get that far. I have a question about the definition of a child. I don't get the difference between 101BEI and 101BEII, and why and in what circumstances you would get to apply the latter, which has a higher age limit than the former. I actually looked this up so I can answer it. In the
cool.
That's.
I was wondering what they were talking about.
That's when a child has been adopted and they have a sibling. Congress has extended the age that the sibling could then be adopted up until 18, and essentially it's a humanitarian, for humanitarian reasons they decided they wanted to, you know, be able to allow people. You had cases in which someone adopted somebody and then found out they actually had an older sibling and wanted to adopt that child.
Oh, you had to be later on.
Yeah, normally say you adopt a 13-year-old,
right,
and bring them home and everything is lovely, and then you find out they actually have a 17-year-old sibling, and the parents want to adopt that one. The, we want to let them adopt that 17-year-old.
But only if the parents.
Well, if they don't, then you're it's not going to come up at all, because...
That would be kidnapping.
Well, not even. It'd be the opposite.
The opposite. It'd be kid-giving.
Kid-giving. Yes, Claudia. Hold on, Claudia, and then you.
But if the older sibling is older than one,
you can adopt. Well, you can adopt, but it won't have significance for immigration purposes. I mean, these are all about immigration purposes, of course. So, I mean, yeah. Yeah.
When the adopted child's situation is not,
it's about when the adoption happens. To be whether they would be determined a child. So if the adoption happens before 16, they're a child. Then a relative applies for that person, if they don't apply until the child is 22, then they're no longer a child. They have to be adopted by 16.
16.
Yeah.
Visible.
Yeah. Okay. I got questions about the exercises on page 343 of your book, if you brought your book. Actually, I'm going to open it up. You're going to hit all these, right?
Nobody's drinking that Diet Coke.
This is my Diet Coke.
Oh, that's yours.
My Diet Coke. And actually, I want to focus on starting on 2. Non-citizen C marries U.S. citizen D and is admitted as an immediate relative under INA 201B. 18 months later, C separates from D. 6 months pass, and the couple has not reconciled. What happens? Yes.
If the marriage is consummated in a good faith, that marriage is fine, and as well as the 3 months prior to removing the petition from the green card, then if you have the logic reason that the marriage was solemnized in a proper way, in a good faith, then you can remove that petition.
Okay. I think that you have all the basics of the answer, but make sure you spell out everything. So if a marriage is less than 2 years old, rather than being given permanent residence, you will be given conditional permanent residence. You're nodding at me, but you have to explain the basics because you skipped over that and just started talking about removing the conditions. So obviously you know it, but you have to spell out the basics on the exam. So basically, and then you, 3 months before the second anniversary, you have to petition to have the conditions removed. So now they've separated. If the husband, or the, I don't know which one is the husband, if the citizen is willing to join with the non-citizen to file a joint petition for removal of conditions, pretty much everything is fine. The fact that they have different addresses may mean that Department of Homeland Security will ask more questions, but if it was a good faith marriage, that should be okay, although they may need additional proof that it was a good faith marriage.
What would be additional proof?
Well, it depends what they submitted to begin with. B, suppose instead that C and D are legally divorced after 20 months. What is the result? Really, to understand this, you need to look at Section 216 of the statute. So, in looking at 216, you look at 216D1. Statement of proper marriage and petitioning process. The facts are that, 1, the qualifying marriage was entered into in accordance with the laws of the place where the marriage took place, has not been judicially annulled or terminated other than through the death of a spouse, and 3, was not entered into for the purpose of procuring an alien's admission as an immigrant, and 2, no fee or other consideration was given other than to the attorney. So now that's clearly not the situation because the marriage has been terminated. So you now need to file a waiver. Probably the one that you would be looking at would be a good faith waiver. But if you remember, if you look through the statute, if you look through C, you'll see the various waivers being listed. And also we went through that in class as well. What if D instead had died? And you'll see that it's still okay because under what I just read, it has not been judicially annulled or terminated other than through the death of a spouse. So for removal of the petition, you're okay if the spouse has died. People feeling comfortable, people basically remembering this, that less than 2 years, if the marriage has existed less than 2 years, you're going to get conditional residence. You then have to petition to have the conditions removed. It's a joint petition, but there's waivers available if a joint petition is not possible.
Just about when he dies. So if he dies 1 month after the marriage, you don't do anything? You just have your
vote of the marriage? Well, you'd have to then petition for removal of the condition still. But you would submit, yourself. And you still have to, I would probably resubmit, yeah, by yourself.
have to file after 1 year and 9 months, even after the diagnosis.
Yeah.
So that's the time of the malnutrition.
Yeah. You have 2 years of condition, you know, of conditional status. Yeah.
I think
we're going to make
up
A McVie situation is if it's basically the McVie situation is focusing it's actually before this, but it's focusing on the good faith marriage at the time of the inception of the marriage. And the idea behind it is if it's not a lifting the petition situation, it's the initial interview on the marriage. You know, if a wife has petitioned for you, even if by the time the interview comes around, that marriage has dissolved, the McVie argument, which is a very difficult argument to get, is that if you can say, look, this was a valid marriage at its inception, you should still be able to get it.
When did the petition start?
Well, it depends when the petition was filed.
Oh.
So, and it depends on when the petition was filed and where you are. Like, New York tends to be more backed up than other places. You know, it would probably take you about, you know, a little less than a year to get an interview date in New York, and in other places might be 3 months. Non-citizen E marries U.S. citizen F and is admitted as an immediate relative. One year later, a child is born. 6 months after that, F walks out and refuses to help E in any further immigration proceedings. What result? Yes?
She can file the petition as a battered woman, and she can adjust that status.
Well, we don't know if she's battered.
I mean, if somebody betrays and leaves somebody at the mercy of the circumstances, yeah, means better.
You know, immigration, walking out doesn't necessarily mean battered.
I mean, it's
but actually, that's going to end up being relevant because there's the question under 3C is clearly trying to get to that. I don't, just simply walking out, you're not going to be able to get a battered wife or.
The idea behind that, if he's not, I'm just supporting his family and he's not responsible for us and leave them themselves.
That's still not battering. And wouldn't be probably extreme cruelty either.
But is there not a reason to file the petition to remove that condition?
But you're. You need to find the section in the statute to get it in. Claudia?
Extreme hardship. Maybe.
Yeah, I would say an extreme hardship waiver. And let's actually look at the hardship waiver is C4. The Attorney General, in the Attorney General's discretion, it's not necessarily, anyway, the answer is here. May remove the conditional basis of the permanent resident status for an alien who fails to meet the requirements of paragraph 1, that's a joint filing, if the alien demonstrates that A, extreme hardship would result if such alien is removed, and it's just extreme hardship, B, the qualifying marriage was entered into in good faith by the alien spouse, but that qualifying marriage has been terminated other than through the death of the spouse, and the alien was not at fault in failing to meet the requirements of paragraph 1 of the joint filing. Or C, the qualifying marriage was entered into in good faith by the alien spouse, and during the marriage, the alien spouse or child was battered or was the subject of extreme cruelty perpetrated by his or her spouse or citizen or permanent resident parent. The alien was not at fault in failing to meet the requirements. In determining extreme hardship, the Attorney General shall consider circumstances occurring only during the period that the alien was admitted for permanent residence on a conditional basis. My thought is that A, there, extreme hardship would result as such. I mean, you can argue a hardship to both the parent and the child. I mean, possibly you could even argue hardship to F. It just, all we know about F is that he doesn't want to help with immigration proceedings. It doesn't say that he doesn't have a parent-child relationship. So if F has actually a parent-child relationship, and if, you know, removing E would mean that the child was taken out of the country, maybe there would also be hardship to F. Yes. I mean, it'd be almost counterproductive, but, presumably you wouldn't get an affidavit from F saying it would be a hardship on me. But, you know, I suppose you could say, like, look, he's got a close relationship with the child, and where, you know, if I get deported, the child is coming with me because I have primary custody.
So it would be
or however it came out. I mean, for practical purposes that you bring up, it's unlikely that would be a very strong argument. But the point I'm trying to make is that it can be hardship to anyone. It's not actually, as opposed to many of the waivers we see that are specifically tied to, like, the U.S. citizen or legal permanent resident child or spouse or parent, this is not tied. You can show.
That also points out something important with waivers, that is, whenever you're looking at hardship, it has to be to a specific person and see who it is and maybe you have a qualifying relationship.
Yes?
I am very confused about that. Extreme hardship and exceptional hardship. But, I mean, there's a very overlapping term.
Extreme is less than exceptional.
They're relative terms.
So very rare kind of.
Quantifiable? No. However, exceptional tends to mean
rare.
Among anybody who would be experiencing hardship to start with, this hardship has to be exceptional. It's just, that's by the court. Again, you can't quantify them, but exceptional is more than extreme. Unusual is, I would say, less than extreme. But you often see it together. Extraordinary and extremely unusual. And if you line them up together, they then multiply exponentially. You won't, whether you can actually quantify them will not matter for your exam.
I think that would actually be a good exam.
No, it won't be on the exam. Suppose instead that the child was born outside the United States after the marriage but before E's admission. Would this make any difference? I'm just going to jump in on that because I don't want to get into a conversation on automatic citizenship or anything like that. What I think they're just looking for there is that there's, I think, more obvious hardship to the child, but except, actually, let me think for a second. The hardship has to be during the period that the alien was admitted for permanent residence. But nevertheless, if they're living with them, obviously then they've deepened their bond, and so the hardship would still apply. So, yeah, it's just looking to the hardship. Yes?
So, is that making a difference? Because I thought, because the child was born before the admission, that now you kind of say that there is extreme hardship to the child?
That's just what I was thinking about. But I think that you could say they still had a parent-child relationship during the conditional period, so there still is hardship developing during the conditional period. So even though the child was born before, I think you're still okay. Although you're right to pick up on that the hardship, again, has to be during the conditional period. Yes?
What if the scenario, the child is not
you know, it still just says extreme hardship would result if such alien is removed. So, you know, I would certainly argue in that case, extreme hardship doesn't say that. It doesn't say it has to be to a U.S. citizen. Would the courts weigh it as seriously? Perhaps not. But by the terms of the statute, I think it still can be included. Then there's another C, just sets up the battered spouse exception, which we just read through. And I'm going to skip it and go to the next type of questions that I got sent, unless people want. Are people okay leaving this subject area? You remember this? You know where to find it in the statute? You feel comfortable? All right, so I'm going to go back to the Child Status Protection Act. Okay. Here come a couple of examples. Mary is a U.S. citizen. And Mary applies for. Oh, I'm making it up. We've done all the ones in the book. Mary applies for her child, Tom, who is 20 years old. The petition is approved 1 year later. Is Tom okay? Or is Tom aged out?
It's okay because the day we approved, that's he would stay 20 years back. I mean,
on the day he.
Petition is approved, visa is available.
You've got it, but he's 21 when it was approved. It's when it was filed. Because it's immigration's fault that they took a year to process the case. The whole thing with the Child Status Protection Act is they want to protect kids who are getting hurt because immigration is taking a long time. They think you have it, just be careful of your word choice. So it's when it's filed, not when it's approved.
In this case, because Mary's a U.S. citizen, the child's age is frozen.
Frozen at the age the petition is received by immigration. I'm saying filed. Really, it's the date that it's received, but that's essentially the same date usually. Okay. Ready for the next one? Joe is a legal permanent resident. Bum, bum, bum. He is not a plumber. Joe applies for his wife, Susan. Susan has two children. Denise, who is 16, and Mario, who is 19. Their priority date, so they file, they receive a priority date. Their priority date is August 2003. The case is approved on September 2004. Their priority date becomes current six years later in September 2010. So, talk to me about Susan, Denise, and Mario. Sorry, just to make it a tiny bit easier, let me change all the months to August. Shane, were you going to?
I was.
Do you need to think about it a second now that I've changed the...
I'm not for sure. I may have missed something, but... Okay, I'll give it a shot. So Denise is 22 at this point, and Mario is 25. So it appears that because the file was pending for a year, it was a year and a month before, right?
All right, hold on for 1 second. So the priority is August 2003. Is that what I said? So that's essentially when he was filed. And at that point, Denise is 16. So priority date becomes current August 2010. How old is Denise? In actual age, Denise is, I think, 23, and Mario is 26. So keep on going.
Okay. So then, if I'm not mistaken, then we take the difference between the date that the I-130 was filed and the date that it's adjudicated, and then we subtract them from their age.
Leaving them at?
And it's 1 year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Denise is 22 and then Mario is 25. So this is now by the month.
Right, so they're both out. What would be the best thing that Joe potentially could have done for Susan, Denise, and Mario? One thing you would have need to know, though. All right. Assuming that Joe married Susan just before he petitioned for them. So he married them, you know, assume in August 2003. Are Denise and Mario Joe's children? For stepchildren. So Denise, yes. Mario, no. So Mario will never become Joe's son or child, because once you haven't established that, you're out. So potentially Joe could apply for Denise. There's something if the marriage had taken place, say, 2 years before, so both kids were clearly under 18. One thing, if this is your exam, that you might want to be thinking of is, could Joe turn around and become a U.S. citizen? Because if he could, these kids would be his immediate relatives, and then there wouldn't be a wait period, and they would be able to come in, as opposed to coming in as adult children, which is going to take years. Adult sons or daughters, sorry.
You're saying that becoming a U.S. citizen is still a kind of process. So if you could wait, like if it didn't, if the...
I mean, it depends if he's eligible to become.
Right.
Like, you have to have been a U.S. citizen, legal permanent resident in most cases for 5 years. So you might want to figure out, hey, Joe, have you been a legal permanent resident for 5 years? Do you speak English? Can you pass the civics exam? What criminal problems have you had? But if the answer is, yeah, I've been here for, you know, 7 years. I don't have any criminal problems. I'm fluent in English. I know my civics. Then, you know, and this is what we mean about, and probably would have got, given you a few more facts on this, but nevertheless, you should be thinking about things like this in this case. Like, oh no, you know, as Susan's derivatives, Denise and Mario are, you know, are not going to make it in. Is there something, some other way we can get them in? And a potential way to get them in is, can Joe become a citizen? And if so, then they would be able to come in and meet relatives, and that'd be much quicker.
And you need to think about that sort of reasonable accommodation. I mean, I had one question where I asked, you know, Sue wants to bring her boyfriend Joe in, and what can she do? And somebody wrote, well, you can't bring your boyfriend in. You know, I mean, it's reasonable to suggest they get married. You know, you really need to think your way around these issues in a fairly flexible way. Now, obviously, we're not going to ask you to enter into fraudulent marriages, etc., but you should be thinking of legal, normal sorts of paths that people might be able to take. I'm not going to call it.
Okay.
Loris is right on the show.
Yes.
on that point, would it be appropriate on an exam to mention that if there were sort of non-frivolous ways of delaying adjudication to sort of create more time, that could be a way of, or is that in the realm of fraudulent marriage?
That's not in the realm of fraudulent marriage. There's nothing unethical in trying to delay things. I think it would be rare. It would be rare that we would ask a question looking for that sort of answer, just because that's more procedural than substantive. But
why don't we take it off the table? The answer is
okay.
Never a delay. There are times when immigration lawyers do try to delay things for various reasons, because your client did something. But that will never be the answer on the exam. Coming up with a new hypothetical.
I am. Okay. Ellen is a legal permanent resident. She applies for her child, Nancy, who is 17, in July 2004. So she is 17 in July 2004. In July 2006, that petition is approved. In July 2011, Nancy's priority date. Actually, let me take that back, sorry. In July 2009, Nancy's priority date becomes current. Can you repeat it? Speaking louder?
I'm sorry. In July 2009, she's 22, but you have a 2-year delay between the petition and the filing. So you can track that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes. Okay. Do people want another one or two Child Status Protection Act questions? Are you feeling comfortable on them? You're feeling comfortable. Okay. Those are all of the questions we have been emailed. Does anyone have any other questions they want to ask, either about the test, specific, substantive questions, or advice on life in general? Yes.
I just have one question. The imputed political opinion question.
Mm-hmm.
What is exactly an imputed political opinion?
You want to do that?
Yeah, sure. You know, if you remember the Supreme Court said that, you know, if you're persecuted for something, you actually has to be something that you have as a belief. So, for instance, neutrality was held not to be a political opinion if you're persecuted for being neutral, because neutrality, according to the court, was not a political belief. However, the Immigration Service subsequently, and you know, this was certainly followed by the BIA and by the federal courts, said that an evolving area of asylum law, the imputed political opinion was still valid. That a person need not hold an opinion so long as they're being persecuted because the persecutor believes they possess the opinion. So in other words, if I'm a right-wing dictatorship and I believe you're a communist, even though you're not a communist, and I persecute you on account of that, the court will not say, well, only communists who get persecuted for being communists are eligible for refugee status or for political asylum. Now they'll say that I've imputed that opinion to you. The persecutor's imputed that opinion, and that's what imputed political opinion is, where you don't actually possess the opinion, but the opinion is imputed to you or is believed to be your opinion by the persecutor.
And all the 5 protected grounds can also be imputed. It can be imputed religion, it can be imputed race.
Yeah, Laura's brought it up earlier. If I persecute you for being a Muslim and you're actually a Sikh, you know, the government's not going to say, well, you know.
Sorry.
It was just a mistake. No, you know, you would still be persecuted on account of imputed religious belief or imputed race. I mentioned my Dominican client who was not attacked, but sort of harassed for being a Muslim. You know, he was essentially, well, I wouldn't say even Muslim, but for being Arab, you know, his race was imputed to him even though he had no relationship to it.
Any other questions? As you do your outlines and prepare for the exam, you may email me questions, or email me and ask for an appointment and to answer questions. The more time it is before the exam, the more likely I am to respond to you. But I will try to respond to you. If it's a week before the exam, you will almost certainly get a response. If it's a day before the exam, you almost certainly will not get a response. So do your studying early.
I have a question about, like, cases. Like, I know we should probably disclose, like, major cases. But if you've got some cases that are, like, not relevant anymore, like, new
cases,
and have to get anything.
Yeah.
Or, like,
we're not going to ask you to give string cites.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, really, if a case is just super connected to the principle you're talking about, like every conversation we've had on a B1, we've mentioned the bricklayers case.
Right.
So that should be in there. You know.
We usually don't bring up the NHL hockey player.
Probably not.
But like with this silence, for example,
there are key cases that maybe would eke you out an extra half point or something like that. And that might be like Cardoza-Fonseca, you know, defining what does a well-founded fear mean. Possibly Mader-Mogherabi, just that's the well-founded fear test. I don't think there...
I don't know. Have you ever deducted if somebody actually
knew what never,
the
standard was? I've never deducted for lack of case names, but I can't say I have added like a point to somebody who, if you're discussing, you know, an FGM asylum case, mentions Kasinga. Again, I'm not going to deduct it for not doing it, but could usually when I'm grading essays, say it's a 16-point essay. Maybe there are five things that I think you should definitely include in your answer. And so each of those I may associate 2 points or 3 points with. And that will add up usually to, say, if it's a 16-point essay, 13 or 14 points. And then I have an additional 2 points that are just kind of discretionary. And if you've, you know, cited cases, cited statute, really shown me a knowledge, you're going to get those 2 points. If you hit the answers but you didn't do anything extra, maybe you won't get that extra point or something.
But it's real important to cite the statute, especially.
Yeah.
Especially with the bars, with the grounds of removal. I mean, that's the easiest way to hit us on. As opposed to, I think on a lot of the bars and stuff, but we're really not looking so much for the case site.
No, I don't think
completely.
I don't think any of the waivers or bars you need to cite to a case.
I'd say if I was going to, you can correct. I would say if I was going to look heavily at case citation, it tends to be in the asylum area. Am I wrong?
There's one or two at like bricklayers.
We're not going to ask you about the Chinese exclusion case or deportation case. It's just, it is good that people know the term plenary powers, but beyond that.
Yeah. And I mean, you're talking about maybe 1 to 2 points on your exam. Like, you're not talking about, you know, if there's something that I'm not going to get an A on if I do perfectly but don't have case sites. You will. And I definitely wouldn't be looking up in your book to try to get case sites and stuff like that if it's not flowing out of your pen or flowing off your keyboard. Other questions? All right. Also, anyone who hasn't done a Shoshi example, if you want to try to make an appointment with me, you still can. And Pat?
Yeah, I mean, I know that Dolores doesn't necessarily agree with me on this, but it's been a pleasure to teach you this year. She's been complaining about it. It's really been enjoyable to teach you guys. It's I think both of us have commented that people seem to be very well prepared coming in to class, and the discussions have been very interesting for us. You know, how many of you have read Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville? Yeah, one. That's about average for the classes. It's so funny because I don't think there's any book that's miscited more in the United States by the news media or by politicians. And in fact, Ronald Reagan came up with a whole section out of Democracy in America that isn't in the book once. It's sort of a source of mythology, but it's a great book to read, especially the first. It's two volumes, but the first volume is probably one of the best contemplations of the development of democracy in the United States. I didn't read it until I was in my 40s. I read the little snippets that you get in poli-sci. Reading the whole book, it's a magnificent book. And whenever I hear people tell me America is in a democracy, and they mean that to say that it's something other than that, and that I'm wrong to say it's a democracy. Tocqueville said it was a democracy, so he's a pretty good expert on it. I used to do a lot of work for website called Snopes.com, which looks at urban legends and analyzes them and tears them apart. And, you know, there's a lot of lawyers and professors who work on that, doctors, and try to put facticity behind, these internet rumors and myths. It's a great site if you get a chance to look at it. But one of the things that every month we get some letter of, who's really the people behind saving American democracy? And you'd always get, why teachers are necessary for democracy. And a lot of times you get very political ones. The soldier is the guardian of American democracy. And it's always been interesting because Tocqueville said who was the guardians of American democracy, and he said it was the lawyers. You know, if you think about it, every society has soldiers, and soldiers can defend the country, they can take over the government, they can kill the people. There's nothing about being a soldier that makes you a defender of democracy. What do people always say America has too much of? Lawyers. That's why we have a good democracy. When you have a lot of democracy, when you have a lot of lawyers, de Tocqueville said, you have a class that is incredibly conservative, and he didn't mean that as political conservatism, but you think about it, lawyers, unlike just about every other field, we look to the past. We look at precedent, right? That's what precedent means. It means the way things have been done before. And it is in our interest to make sure that things follow precedent, that they follow the laws as they evolve from legislative bodies that are popularly elected. If you have a dictatorship, if you have a king, you don't need a lot of lawyers. You only need a lot of lawyers in a democratic society. So what are lawyers? Lawyers are extremely well-educated people who earn above, you'll all complain about your salaries, but you'll earn above the median American income, which is about $45,000 a year. And always remember that about 70% of Americans make less than $80,000 a year. You're going to be in, although you'll never feel this, you're going to be in what is essentially an elite within the American society. And within that society, you have a material interest in defending democracy and in defending due process. And Tocqueville says the material interest is extremely important. We live in a capitalist society. If there's no due process, lawyers don't get paid. So you are there. And I think, look at who drafted the Constitution. It wasn't really, or the Declaration of Independence. It's not really soldiers, great soldiers who did. George Washington's father of his country didn't do a heck of a lot to put these great documents together. You even think of the Gettysburg Address or Lincoln's Second Inaugural. They're not done by General Grant. They're done by a lawyer, by Abraham Lincoln. Lawyers just have this very important role within American society. When you get out there, you got to remember that only 30% of Americans have a college degree. Okay? 70% don't. About 1% have a doctoral level degree like you do. I'm guessing that if you're like me and you go back five generations in your family, nobody knew how to read. Okay, so, you're only a few generations removed from the last illiterate in your family's history. You've got tens of thousands of years of the illiterates, and then somebody learned how to read, and then somebody after them maybe went to high school, and maybe a generation or two ago, if you're lucky, somebody in your family went to college. So you didn't just go to college. You went to college. You did exceptionally well. You went on to law school. You have a huge amount of your own money invested in yourself. But let's also remember these are social resources that have been invested in you. And if you think beyond America and you think of the whole world, I mean, it's, you're probably in the 1/100 of 1% most educated people in the entire world. And that can make you feel very entitled. You know, part of what law school does, and Loris never likes me to say this, part of what law school does is it's there to give you a hard time so that when you come out you feel like you can rape and pillage at your will and make as much. Doctors are the same way, right? I mean, we put them through all this crap so that when they come out and they're making money, they don't feel any guilt about it. Well, I'm not asking you to feel guilt, but I think you should realize that there are plenty of people in the world who work really hard. I used to be an assembly line worker, and that was the hardest job I ever had. When you come out, it's very easy to focus strictly on paying back your loans, making money, buying a house, and getting the good life, although I'm kind of guessing you're not going to get that if you're getting out this year, unfortunately. It might be delayed a few years. But when you get out, you really need to remember that most of society doesn't have the advantages that you have, and particularly immigrants coming here. I mean, they're often the despised and the damned within the society, and they really need people like you either to work directly for them or to work in pro bono projects. I mean, you could be making a lot of money. Bob Jaseum, very well-known attorney. What's the matter? Oh, stop it! He was the head of the ABA's pro bono project on political asylum. I would think that you would have known that. He was really one of the foremost attorneys in getting Haitian refugee rights secured during the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah, when I was practicing so avidly. Sorry, carry on.
Well, I'm really sorry that you're younger than I am. What can I tell you? He was at the Carissa dinner, in fact, on last week. Anyway, Bob Jaseum. You know, somebody who's working in a corporate law practice who then devotes time to the protection of refugees, Haitian refugees, particularly those who were detained in Florida. So, you know, this is something else that you can do while you're creating your career. And then I always say to people, you know, if you can't do it and you can't help out, donate money. It's always sad that attorneys are generally among the least generous people in the United States. You'll find that a day laborer is more likely to donate money to a charity generally through his or her church as a percentage of total income than an attorney. When you get out, remember, you need to support those projects that represent people who you don't represent, that the poor need to be represented, that individuals who might be in despised minorities need to be represented, that, just think back 20 or 30 years, or not think back, but study your history books 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, homosexuals were a despised minority. African Americans were a despised minority. Women were a despised majority. These are all groups of individuals who really, without people donating money, people donating time, and people dedicating their lives to these causes, really would be in the same abject situation that they had been in 40 or 50 years ago. So I wish you guys well. I hope everybody does really well on the final exam, although I think we need to have one person not do well. Okay. Yeah, usually I also give a lecture on the curve. But I also hope that when you get out and you're in practice that you remember that, you know, you are there, as Alexis de Tocqueville said, as really the bastion of democracy and fair play in the society. So good luck.
Thank you very much.
And take any of the extra pastry, please. Loris is not allowed to eat any of it, right? Aren't you trying to lose weight? That was one of the discussions.